So this is talking with Alec Little on 8 March 78 at the University of Sydney. Well, can you tell me when you first joined radio physics and how you eventually became involved in radio astronomy?
Yeah, sure. I joined the radio physics laboratory as a junior office boy in 1940, and then I've forgotten the exact date, but it was about a year or so later I joined the workshop, moved into the workshop staff. And I spent about 3 years in the workshop when Joe Pawsey invited me to be a lab assistant, which in those days was a bit rare because they didn't have anybody, any juniors in those days. I was the first one, I think, in the radio physics lab anyway. So then I spent most of the time working with Joe in the group that was concerned with propagation and antennas. And I worked for various people, Harry Manette and a few of these other people. Ruby was there in those days. And I can remember actually in that lab actually poking an antenna out the...
Tell me about this.
I only remember doing the thing. I didn't know quite what it was all about, of course. And I remember Joe getting me to poke an antenna out the window and point it at the sky to see if we could see any sky noise. The result was nil.
What kind of antenna was it?
It was a horn. It wasn't a very big one. It was a horn. I think it was 10 centimetres was the sort of wavelength that we were working on.
And what year would you
I've tried to look back and try and remember when this was, and I just can't pin it down precisely.
But it was Pawsey's instigation?
It was Pawsey, yes.
And do you remember if he was... if he knew about the reports from Hay at that time?
Oh, I'm sure he must have done, but I wasn't really, you know, in those days I was very much a junior, so I didn't have a great deal of knowledge of what he did.
Well, that's interesting. I've heard that before, but now I've got it from the horse's mouth.
Right, yes. So I went to work in the...
Let me just ask. Yeah. Did you purposely try to find the sun, or was it just
looking
at the sky?
No, it was the sky, actually. Oh. It wasn't the sun. We didn't actually point it at the sun.
And you didn't even worry about if it was the Milky Way or not?
No, it was just a matter of sticking it out the window, as far as I remember, and see what we could see. But I think that probably the receivers were so poor.
Yeah.
It was just
Well, and also it could be taken as an experiment to see what the emission of the atmosphere was.
Yes. But what Joe had in mind, I couldn't really say.
Okay. Yeah. Well, excuse me. Okay, go ahead.
That's all right, fine. I eventually, after the war, joined the Valve Lab, in those days, which was out in the Electrical Engineering Building, and we developed, working with a chap named John Gooden originally, and he started the development of a million volt X-ray machine using some of the radar techniques that we had, and there were various people working in that lab, but I was working with Gooden, and he eventually went to go to Birmingham, and Bernie Mills took over the project, and we carried it through to a fairly successful conclusion, got it working.
What year was that?
And that was 46, 47, sort of 48 time. And then when that sort of folded up, that group, I was asked by Joe, or given the opportunity by Joe and by Taffy, to join either the RAIN physics group or to work on this new field, this radio astronomy field, and I was able to choose the latter as the job. And the first thing that I was given to do then was to develop a swept lobe interferometer. And Ross Trahan was the other man that was associated with that project in the early days, the first part of it.
As a technician?
He was a research officer in those days, but he actually left the radio physics laboratory and became head of the radio engineering course at the Institute of Technology. I think it was the Institute of Technology then. It was the Tech, and then it became the Institute of Technology.
So he didn't really do anything significant.
He didn't really get to the stage where we actually got it working. We were starting to work, and I was developing it.
Well, whose idea was the basic idea?
Oh, I think it must have been Joe's originally. It certainly was presented to me as that sort of idea, and I think it was Joe's. I don't know whether it was Ross. Ross had anything to do with it or not. And it was only later that, how did it work? When Ross left, it needed some guidance of a more skilled professional research officer, and that's where Ruby came in, because Ruby at that stage had been working on the sun for some years.
Right.
She had started at Dover Heights with observing the sun with some Yagis, but then she'd moved to Hornsby, a valley in Hornsby, with Kerr and Shane, where they had their original Moon Echo stuff.
But then when
she got involved with this, we decided to set up a new field station. We had started to do this at De Havilland's aircraft, back of De Havilland Aircraft Corporation, Bankstown Aerodrome, but it was too noisy. It was no good, so we decided, and it was also, we got broken into at one stage with some equipment pinch, so we decided it was time to get out. So we set up the Potts Hill station, and we started there with the stuff that Ruby had brought from Hornsby. She had a trailer full of receivers working at 60 and 90, I think, megahertz.
So this was the first thing done at Potts Hill?
Yes, I believe so. And we set up the interferometer there on the edge of the reservoir, so water supply reservoir. And we were subsequently joined there by various people, Piddington, Manette, I think. I don't know whether Harry actually came out there, but Piddington had a centimetre receiver there, and I think Jim Heineman was connected with that early stage, looking at the sun, measuring the radiation of the sun at centimetre wavelengths. And also then Chris came out, and they brought the large antenna, the 25-foot square paraboloid from Dover Heights. Not Dover Heights, George's Heights, I think. That was the thing that was used by Fred Lahaney. Well, I can't remember who worked with him then, whether it was Don Yadley. So that was brought out to Potts Hill and mounted up in a way that could be used to follow the sun as well. So we had a sort of a solar group out there originally.
Now, what aspect of the swept lobe interferometer did you work on?
Well, I was concerned mostly with the electronics, the engineering side, getting it going, actually. Mm-hmm. That was the technical help. And Ruby, of course, was concerned with the reduction of the observations and interpretation and so on.
And what particular problems did you encounter in making this rather different type of thing, to say the least?
Well, I don't know that there were any very difficult engineering problems. Radio astronomy was good fun in those days because you could build these things relatively easily, and even though it might have been a rather different sort of instrument, the only difficult part was the rotation of the phase, and we chose to do it one way, and we could do it 100 different ways today. That was a bit messy the way we did it, but it worked.
What was that way?
That was using just a piece of transmission line bent around into a circle with a pick-off point driven by a motor.
Oh, I see.
Very straightforward in that sense, but there are other ways of doing it, which perhaps if I'd had the background I have now, I might have done it.
But it worked. That's
it worked,
important
sure,
thing.
That's right. Right. And got results.
And it also measured the polarization.
Yes.
How did it do that?
Well, it had crossed Yagis, and you could switch from one plane of polarization to the other, and by looking at the shift in the sine wave, the output of the machine was essentially a sine wave, sinusoidal output, and if you look at the phase and amplitude of that, you could interpret what the polarization was. So you took two records, one with them one way and one with them crossed.
But you also had two different baselines, intense
yes,
spacing.
That's right, yes.
Is this to remove the lobe ambiguity?
Right, yes, so we had the problem there. That was a basic problem of trying to interpret where they were on the sun. And that, of course, we soon found we needed this extra spacing in order to try and resolve that ambiguity.
Oh, see, that wasn't part of the original design.
No, not really. I mean, the first thing was just a pair of aerials, and I think we soon found we had to have that extra aerial to separate.
Now, did both baselines operate simultaneously, or how did you have that?
You know, I can't remember. It's funny, isn't it? We only had one receiving system, and we must have switched from one to the other. I think that was the way we did it. Took one record with one spacing, another record with the next spacing.
But rather fast.
Fast, yes. Yeah. It's quite good.
Because you want to look at the same
sure.
same
yeah, looking at bursts, you see. So.
Right.
And in actual fact, Ruby, we got to the stage of actually observing quite a few big, large events, solar noise storms and so on. We had observed a lot of bursts, but in fact the bursts were never really reduced properly. We never really got down to the nitty-gritty of finding out where they were on the sun. And in retrospect, one can't be sure what one did in these days. I remember there was a difficulty. I tried this after Ruby left, didn't we? The thing she left to go home and have a baby. And so she gave up research. And I think I tried to actually determine the positions of some bursts, and I wasn't successful. And now, in retrospect, it probably was because, you know, you get this problem of them hopping around on the sun.
You think that's what was happening? Well, that may have been.
Yeah. In retrospect, that may have been part of the problem.
Well, let me just ask about... Ruby Painscott on the phone did tell me about the fact that she had to keep her marriage secret, or else she would... Do you remember exactly the timing of that? How long was she actually secretly married?
Well, I don't know. You see, she was so secret.
Oh, that's not even you knew.
No, I didn't know. I didn't really know that Ruby was married until she announced that she was going to be a baby. I knew she had a friend.
Yeah.
I didn't really know how long she was married.
Was the other thing I'm not clear about was the regulation changed before she quit? Or did she announce it when the regulation was changed, or only when she was going to quit?
I don't know. Okay. I don't remember the details.
Okay. Well, it's just a little vignette.
Sure. People that were closer to Ruby would know, of course. Although I worked with her, of course, I didn't. I was still very much junior these days.
Well, let's talk some more about the science that was done with this thing. There was a series of papers where you saw many noise storms, and in some of the cases, you were able to get the actual positions.
Sure.
And from the abstract I have here, that they didn't always coincide with the sunsets.
Right. Yes.
Was this expected at all, or was this?
Oh no, I don't think we in those days really knew quite what to expect. Although I think the interpretation soon was fairly obvious. I guess people like Steve would know a little bit better the actual progression of events here. But I think it was understood, even when we were doing this, that the radiation was coming from high up in the solar atmosphere.
Right.
But, so I think the interpretation of the velocities and so on was based on that sort of idea.
Right, but this was, I think, probably the first direct measurement of, these coronal positions.
Yes, well, we were able to follow things from day to day, you see, which was very helpful.
Could you...
Although, you see, they must have had some inkling from this from the 46 stuff, I think.
Well, there they knew that the radio bursts were coming from a small
spots,
part of the
yes.
sun associated with spots, but more than that, no.
Yes.
I think this was the first measurement that they were actually out in the corona.
Yes.
And also, you were measuring circular polarization through proper phasing of these cross dipoles, and therefore getting some handle on the magnetic fields in these sunspots. Let's see, what else? Other papers came out of that. Now, how fast could you follow movement? I mean, could you follow it over a couple of minutes and see a burst move out?
Oh, sure. I mean, you could follow it all day. We used to observe plus or minus 2 hours around transit, and the observations would be continuous in that period.
And was this set up to be monitoring virtually all the time?
Sure. Yeah, every day. Well, not weekends. We didn't usually do that because that was meant somebody having to go out there. I mean, occasionally, if there was a big sunspot group, then we might go out and observe.
And so you just had endless strip chart recordings?
No, these were recorded on 16mm film, actually.
I see.
The endless strip charts were the sort of continuous monitor of the total radiation from the sun, 60 and 90-odd megahertz records that Ruby had brought from Hornsby. But these records were only taken whenever the level exceeded a certain amount. In other words, the camera was set to trigger whenever the radiation rose above it.
I see. So you had an automatic thing there.
Yes. In those days, it was quite pleasant. You could sit out in the sun, you see, and waiting for a burst to come along.
Well, that's interesting that you had an automatic device, because if I remember correctly, Paul Wilde telling me that at Dapto, they had a loudspeaker. And when they heard something, they would rush in and turn it on.
Yes.
Why didn't...
I was curious,
they didn't hook up something like that.
I don't know whether could have done, I suppose.
I didn't think about asking you.
No, it's a question of what level, probably. We were concerned more with the very high-level things, and it's easier to make that trigger, although you could easily trigger it off a lower level if you really set your mind to.
Is the reason that you were doing the higher burst because you needed that signal noise, or...?
No, there was not much problem with signal noise. There was... bags for the sort of things that we had. I mean, for example, the ordinary strip chart recorders used to go off scale, and most of the time when there was a noise storm, you'd have to change the gain.
No, I guess that's right.
That was always a problem, so there was no
with the sun, that's not a problem.
No, not really.
So, was it a scientific reason then to only look at the most strongest, or what?
I think we probably just felt that, you know, we had to start somewhere and some cut off, otherwise we'd be trying to measure a whole lot of little things, which might not have been terribly relevant. We didn't make any conscious effort to reduce the limit. I mean, it was an arbitrary sort of a limit that we set.
Okay. Then you calculated a velocity here of around 500 to 3,000 kilometers a second. Now, this is parallel with Paul Wilde's work.
Right, yes.
Were you two in contact about the interpretation?
Oh, yes, sure. His field station was a different place, of course. Right. He started off at Penrith and went to Dapto.
But by this time he was at Dapto, I guess.
Yes, that's right. And there was certainly contact, although, again, this would have been mainly at Ruby, between Ruby and Paul, rather than myself and the Dapto group. I was the contact I would have had would have been more at the technical level.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's move on to the next experiment, unless there's something else I should know about that one.
I think that the covers mostly. As I say, it sort of dribbled on for a while, and until finally we gave it up because Paul at this stage had got his interferometer going at Dapto, and they didn't...
Did he have an
interference interferometer going down at Dapto, I believe.
Didn't remember this quite that early.
It wasn't when we were working. I think it might have been towards the end, but Kevin Sheridan and those people could tell you more clearly on this.
Okay, I may be mixed up.
Yeah.
But anyway...
I had that impression that they did have an interferometer going of some sort at that stage.
And so you were saying then that this was why you closed up, or...
Well, no, I think Ruby left, of course.
Oh, that's
and,
right.
And there were other things coming along that needed some technical people, and I swapped over to those. And that's really how it went.
So how was it that you came to work on the first model Mills Cross? And...
Well, we'd finished the work at, I think this is now thinking back over it, this is really when the transition was made from the interferometer to the other work that I was doing, because probably I was sort of sitting there waiting for things to happen on the sun, and Bernard had got this idea to build a cross, and I was asked by Joe to work for Bernard to actually construct the thing and try it out. Because Joe really didn't believe it. He always maintained we should have made it on a turntable so we could turn it around.
I see. Joe Posse. So this was you mean Mills himself probably would not have bothered with the model. He was...
Oh, I think so. I think yes. I think we always proceed slowly in radio physics in those days. We like to sort of proceed step by step, and I think the principle really had to be established. there was a certain amount of not opposition to it, but just not lack of understanding, skepticism. Yes.
Do you remember in particular what those arguments were?
No, I don't really. Bernard would probably be more.
Okay, so what was your job as?
Well, then
I
was given the job to actually get the thing to make one, to build it and pop it.
Both the aerial and the receiver.
Right. Yes. So that was a very simple thing, of course. In fact, I have a photograph of it, which I can produce. And,
yes, I'd like to see that.
I'll give you a copy of that. It's only just was made of chicken wire and bits of fencing wire, and was quite a simple, cheap thing to construct. So that's why it was an easy thing to do. So it was worth doing. A lot of the receiver stuff was standard practice. You see, Mills at this stage had been working at Badgery's Creek,
right,
using his interferometer, so all the techniques for phase switching and so on were readily available. It was only really a matter of collecting together enough of the bits to actually try it out and just building an array, a simple array. And
so it just only took a few months then to...
Yeah, sure, yes. I can't remember the exact time we started. We've got a whole lot of bits and pieces here, but... that's just a book. In those days, it was a really bad boy. Second to the first, 53. Well, that would be about when we started.
January 53.
I can remember sort of finishing my tech exams and going on holidays and coming back and doing this project.
And I think on the cover it said August 53.
Finished in about August 53. Yes,
right.
So it was completed the work and the observations. Yeah.
In fact, the paper that you published was in 53 also.
Yes.
Must have been at the end of 53.
Yes. Yes, a high resolution thing, that's right, yes. Well, that probably was published as soon as... It was probably submitted fairly early on, I think.
Right.
It was, actually.
And that indeed is a classic paper, I would say now. So it worked.
It worked, yes, right.
Nothing unexpected about it.
No, not really. And I think we had a few minor technical problems. I can remember it was all very hairy, the whole thing. It was made of transmission lines with very thin copper wires, you know, and I had various people at various stages helping me. We had two Indians working with us, Govan Swarup, Radhakrishnan was the other. Mm-hmm. Not Radhakrishnan, sorry, Parthasarthi, who works in Alaska. And I had a Sati weapon.